Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to welcome back Mark Dwyer. Mark is the landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. Beautiful gardens, and I visited a number of times and really enjoy going through them every time I am there. So it's great to have him back. It's been quite a while since he's been with us. I am really pleased to have him here to talk about flowers and shrubs and maybe a little about trees. We certainly want to talk about fragrant flowers. A lot of the flowers these days lack fragrance. Many of them do. Some of the showier ones often are not very nice, smelly. I don't know. Is that smelly is not fragrant. Let's put it that way. That's a better word, isn't it, Mark?
Yes.
So we have lots to talk about, and I hope you'll join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Or if you have a question you want to post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, maybe you've got a photo you want to include, we'd certainly welcome that as well. So just go to The Larry Mueller Show for that. And great to have you back, Mark.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I really appreciate it. And how are things at the garden right now?
Well, it's been pretty hot, as you know, although I think the gardens in terms of color and interest are really peaking for summer interest. So things are going very well this year, despite the lack of rainfall, which we're getting quite a bit today thus far.
Well, we had an emailer who had a tree. Actually, she went to our Facebook page and posted three photos of a tree that is looks to be about two-thirds of the roots maybe are out of the ground. The tree is pushed over, wondering whether or not they could pull that tree back up. I told her, in the meantime, water until we had you on. Mm-hmm. But to me, it looked like it might be a problem setting it back up and getting it to re-root.
I would agree. You know, the picture we're looking at, it looks like a maple of some sort with a maybe even a 12-inch diameter trunk, and it's huge, maybe 30, 35 feet. The issue with that tree is not only when it tipped, all those roots on one side crack, the ones that we see up in the air, but on the other side, the reverse side, they've also broken underground or compressed. So while the tree can be set back in place and watered and staked to a certain degree, essentially what it'll be is a huge windsail. And the reason trees that big are rarely planted, or when they are planted, I should say, they have enormous root balls to contain a lot of roots. So I think the root ratio to live canopy right now would make it not worth the time. I personally at home would not do it. But again, if they have an attachment to this tree, they could try it, but they'll have to have it staked for years until those roots redevelop.
So her other alternative was firewood, and that might be
the way to go.
And we had a Facebook question from Gail, who wonders, how do you get the cardoon looking so good at the Rotary Gardens? I started to plant this spring and has also gotten a few new leaves. What do I need to do?
Well, cardoon, we grow lots of cardoon at the gardens. It's a close artichoke relative, beautiful silvery leaves. When we grow it at the gardens, it ends up getting 4 to 5 feet tall with very architectural leaves, and that's probably what Gail remembers seeing. There's four things you need to do with cardoon to make it successful and get some good size on, and that's definitely full sun. It needs very moist soil, lots of water, and of course organic soils, rich soils are the way to go. What we'll also do is the oldest leaves on the outside of the plant, as those start to fade and flop, we tear those off. So what we're doing is encouraging the new leaf production from the center of the plant. The other thing we do is we actually will deadhead it. If it actually forms a flower stalk, and granted the flowers are beautiful, these huge violet blue thistles, we deadhead it. We want it to put energy into leaves. We also order ours already started. So Gail sounds like she started hers from seed, and it'll catch up with again those conditions I mentioned. Ours at the gardens right now are almost 3 feet tall, and that's because they heard an early jump.
Oh, that's beautiful. You know, before we go back, Pam's online with a question, but describe the garden for us. So you have several things going on at the Rotary Garden in Janesville.
We do. The gardens themselves are on 20 acres of land. We've been in existence for 22 years, and we have theme gardens. For instance, English cottage garden, a French formal garden, Japanese garden, lots and lots of different garden spaces. We feature over 4,000 varieties of plants. Unfortunately, we're not very well known. Our marketing budget's pretty small, so we hope people will visit and spread the word. The gardens themselves, we host all sorts of educational programs in the area, symposiums, and other offerings. And we're meant not only for visitation and enjoying the beauty of the gardens, but our sole mission is to promote horticultural education and appreciation, and that's why we're there.
Yeah, we posted a link to your website on my Facebook page at the Larry Mealer Show. So I'd encourage listeners go online to the Facebook page at the Larry Mealer Show and click on it. You can see what's going on there. There's a lot going on. And let's go to Pam in Hartford with a question now. Pam, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning. We trimmed a locust tree down a few weeks back. And now we have locust seedlings all over in the yard, in the grass, a few in the flower beds. Of course, with the dry heat, the lawn's not been growing, but the seedlings have.
Mm-hmm.
So just trying to figure out what's the best way to get rid of them. There's probably like a dozen and a half.
Mm-hmm. My guess is the seedlings are not true seedlings. I think they're probably root suckers. I think what's happened is when you prune your locust, you encourage some growth underneath the soil, and we've seen the same thing at the gardens. The bad news for you is removal has to be manual. You can't, of course, coming up in your lawn, you don't want to be applying herbicides anyway, but the reality is you have to get a sharp spade and keep cutting those out, and it's a perpetual job. There's not an easy way to eliminate those root suckers without damaging the plant itself.
Can you just mow? Mowing them just when you mow the lawn?
Well, yes, we did mow some down, but we had set the branches close to the curb on the lawn there, and they're also there. So that's why I question if they're root suckers or not, because there's not any directly under the tree. They're all...
I see.
Further into the lawn.
Okay, so when you placed your cuttings, they had already gone to seed, and you think they're true seedlings then?
Apparently, yeah.
Okay. Well, in that case, that may be a better case scenario. If you can just get under them, and you might have to sacrifice a little turf, but you can get under them and loosen them, they are a bear cat to pull by hand.
Yes, I've made a few attempts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, try to loosen them up on a real wet day. Even soak them. It sounds contrary, but give them a good watering and then try to jerk them out of there and just be vigilant, and you'll win the battle eventually.
Okay, so even if we think we have it out, there's nothing we can put on the remainder that would kill it?
My concern, again, would be if there is some connection to the parent plant.
Uh-huh.
I think if you find that you're having a lot of, as the seedlings come up, if they're separated, if you're not pulling up a lot of long roots that seem connected, you certainly could use some sort of a brush be gone or a heavy-duty herbicide. But again, you run the risk of damaging your turf, which is, you know, up to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, there's just a lot.
Right.
Some of them are like 8 to 12 inches tall now.
Sure. Yeah. The growth rate is unbelievable.
Yeah. So dry.
Sure.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Yep. Good luck. Thanks for calling, Pam. Sarah in Madison, it's your turn now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
I have slug damage in the grass in my backyard. It pulls out really easy. I guess they eat the roots and stuff like that. And I don't really care about grass. I didn't really want to have a lawn anyway. So I was thinking of planting like perennials or something else that I don't have to mow. But I'm wondering if I should still have the slugs taken care of, like if they're going to continue and if it's going to damage other plants that I might plant, or if they only like grass.
Probably not slugs, is it? I wouldn't think underground, Mark. Or...
No, actually, the symptoms you're seeing are probably something else. It's certainly something below ground.
I meant grubs, not slugs. I'm sorry.
Grubs. Okay, sure. Yeah, grub damage is prevalent. And we'll start to see more of it as we get into August with our turf at Rotary Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases, they're very selective with their nibbling on plant roots, and in that case, turf is one of the preferred feeding plants. But I wouldn't worry so much about your other perennials in terms of grub damage. They do prefer lawns typically because they're irrigated and there's plenty of water. So if you're removing your turf, and I would encourage you to dig up some of those dying spots, and you'll probably find white grubs very shallow underneath there doing exactly what you think they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I wouldn't have that same concern about other perennials if you develop it into a perennial bed. The grubs will vacate and will probably relocate to other areas of turf in the area, to be honest. There are lawn treatments for grubs, and depending on how you feel about chemicals, those treatments are very effective in killing grubs in the turf.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking today with Mark Dwyer, landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post right there. Lots of different things to take into account when you're planning a garden. We've got height, bloom time, color, but we don't always think about scent. And how do we incorporate scent into a good garden design?
Well, scent is so important. And think about in the winter months when you're going through your catalogs and you see so many plants advertised as fragrant. Well, what's important to remember is, of course, fragrance is very subjective. You know, people like different smells of perfumes, different fragrances of cologne, etc. It's the same out in the garden. And I think universally, when we smell lilacs, we enjoy that. We remember it. We expect it. But in our summer gardens and throughout the year, there's many plants that are very fragrant. It's important to remember that fragrance is sometimes emitted from flowers. And oftentimes fragrance is a condition of leaves. It's something that needs to be tactilely sort of stimulated. For instance, many of the herbs.
Sure.
You know, walking by basils, there's a slight fragrance, but you really smell it when you rub the leaves. And that's just one example of many. At the gardens this year, we have what's called our Smelly Garden. And we're featuring a garden space dedicated to about 180 varieties of perennials and annuals that are extremely fragrant. Many of which are fragrant in the evening, are dusk-blooming plants with sweet fragrance to attract pollinators. And we're trying to educate people on the reasons why plants are scented, whether it's to attract pollinators or to deter insect damage. There's lots of reasons for that, but we all strive for scent in the garden, and I think it's something we should do and do more often.
So actually, stopping by the gardens, the Rotary Garden, you'd get a good chance to smell different plants and maybe pick ones that you would enjoy.
Sure. In this garden is literally hands-on. We encourage people to smell the flowers, and we also have all sorts of containers with various scented geraniums and mints and other plants, and the kids are just loving it. And, of course, kids of all ages can enjoy the scent in the garden.
Karen in Cumberland has a question or comment. Hi, Karen.
Hi, good morning.
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 I have ornamental sweet potatoes in different places, but they seem to be eaten by something. And I'm wondering if there's some way to get rid of that.
Well, sweet potatoes are tasty for a lot of critters. And at Rotary Gardens, we're seeing a lot of damage. You're probably seeing maybe small, smooth holes in the leaves.
Yes.
In most cases, that's earwigs, which emerge at night and do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are various ways to treat earwigs, but we don't do it at the garden simply because we have sweet potato vine everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And we are concerned about the using chemicals at the gardens. You'll notice sweet potatoes, as you know, are very vigorous.
Yes.
And we notice earwig damage as it starts to get hotter and hotter this summer is on the wane. So we'll actually prune out some of the more damaged leaves, and you get new growth regenerating, and that'll fill out the plant. So if you are interested in chemical control, I would contact your local extension agent and see what they recommend. But earwigs, the population fluctuates year to year, and they're here to stay. It's just, again, your sweet potato vine will recover from just about any sort of damage, but never be shy about cutting it back and letting it regenerate.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Mark Dwyer, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have some open lines. If you have a question for Mark Dwyer of the Rotary Gardens in Janesville, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show as well if you want to post a question or comment. Danielle in Eau Claire, it is your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have two words, Japanese beetles.
Oh.
It's confirmed. And we're just starting out gardening, and then I look in my hibiscus plant, and I saw some of these beetles, I looked online, and they're Japanese beetles. And then we found them decimating our birch tree in the front. There's just millions of them. And right now what we're using to get rid of them is EcoSmart insecticide, and we use it with a hose, and we spray down the tree. But, I mean, it's like an uphill battle. But I want to make sure that they don't burrow into the lawn and lay their larvae. Is that something I have to be concerned about? And if there's any other tips for getting rid of them?
Good, real good questions. And of course, birches are a tasty tree for Japanese beetles, as are many other plants. And it sounds like with your spray treatment, it's effective temporarily, and then a new batch moves in, and we're seeing a huge population at Rotary Gardens right now. Now, I've heard some way to control some of the adult damage are systemics. Those are chemicals that are incorporated into the plant, something that you would sprinkle around your birch tree a month and a half ago, and the chemicals are taken up in the plant, making it less tasty for the Japanese beetles. And there's been some effectiveness with that treatment, but in regards to the grub stage, the adults will burrow in, the females will burrow in later this summer and lay their eggs, which will form into the grubs later next spring. I would get online and research their life cycle in a little more detail, but we treat our lawns, our turf at Rotary Gardens was treated probably, a couple weeks ago for grub control. So your timing for grub control can take care of the emergence of those grubs in those beetles causing damage. The issue, however, is if your neighbors aren't doing it, these things are extremely mobile. And a good example for us is we're surrounded by a golf course, and they don't treat for the grub stage of Japanese beetle. So we're treating our 6 acres of turf, but they're not doing it. And, of course, all the area neighborhoods, they're flying in. So there's lots of good resources online on how to deal with it. I have to tell you, it's so frustrating for us, and I do wish you the best.
Golf courses are the worst because it's like a lawn, and it's watered heavily. And so if you're even anywhere close to a golf course, it can be a problem. One thing that Phil Pelletieri has mentioned is that there seems to be, when the beetles come in, there seems to be kind of a life cycle or a cycle where they grow in exponential numbers, and then they start to fade back, and after about 10 years. But, of course, that does you no good at all now, Danielle. But we hope there's some sort of balance that comes back into it eventually. In the meantime, good luck trying to get rid of them. Do not put up traps.
No. I looked that up, and they said it draws in more. So
if you could get your neighbors to put them up.
Okay.
Sometimes.
That's the joke. Get your neighbors to put them up, and that'll keep them out of your yard.
Yeah. That's what we're thinking. If we can just get them to move on to the next lawn, I don't know. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Rick in Madison, let's go to you. Hi, Rick.
Hi, guys. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I have a hydrangea question.
Okay.
I have, I put six in last year towards the end of the summer around my deck, and they seemed to take really well, and they all had blue, real nice blue flowers on them. And they made it through the winter okay, but they had those long, when everything died off and I cleared all the leaves away, they had those long shoots, the dead shoots, coming out of the ground. And I, at the beginning of spring this year, I trimmed some of those back on all six of the plants. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of wondering if I made a mistake, because actually the plants have come back. They're all real strong and healthy, and they're growing real well. Mm-hmm. Of course, I've had to water them, during this heat spell we've had. But only one of them is flowering. Did I do something wrong?
Well, possibly. Rick, do you recall the variety name on those?
No, but I picked them up at one of the local places, and they've got real pretty big blue flowers that, mm-hmm. that come out of all of them, and
right.
I'm not real sure of the actual variety.
Sure. Well, and that type of hydrangea, when you see the pretty blues like that, that's what's called a macrophylla-type hydrangea. And years ago, all the varieties, the older varieties, they will not flower on new wood. So if it's an older variety, you'll get the vigorous growth like you're getting now, but you won't get the blooms because the flower buds are they won't regenerate flower buds for this summer.
Okay.
However, in the past 7-8 years, there's been developments in those types of hydrangeas, the blues and pinks, where they'll flower also on new wood. And okay. So my comment to you is that you'll know in the next couple of weeks or month or so as they start budding out, right, or not, you'll know if you did the right or wrong thing. But again, the growth sounds very good, and your watering regime is perfect, but the reality is it's all dependent on the variety.
Well, then, I'm kind of wondering, I bought them all from the same place. I'm assuming they were all the same, but I'm kind of surprised that one of them is blooming very nicely, and it started pretty early on, and I did the same trimming with that one that I did with the other ones. But are you saying that, so for next year, when I clear everything away, just leave that old deadwood where it is?
Right. What I would do, and I have in my backyard, I have the same deal, same type of hydrangeas.
Right.
I leave all that scraggly growth until I see where the new buds are emerging.
Okay.
So I don't make cuts until I see leaves come out.
Right.
And then I shape accordingly. But we're really pushing people to get these new varieties simply because it doesn't matter. If we have a severe winter and they die way back, they'll still grow, have flowers on the new growth.
Okay.
So, you know, I wish you luck. If one of them's blooming and they're all the same, they should be okay is my thought on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I'll just have to wait, and for the rest of the yard, I'll put the new ones in.
Okay.
Right.
Thanks, Rick.
Guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We have an email from Nora in Viola who says, we have a major bug issue this year in our raspberries, maybe because of the lack of rain. She wonders, what can we do to save our crop?
Well, it's a great question. Of course, it's really dependent on the insect and what it's doing to the raspberries. I'm guessing leaf damage, maybe fruit damage. That's a great case for collecting some of those insects and maybe taking some photos and getting them to your local extension agent. And they'll be able to diagnose and give you some ideas on how to deal with it, whether it's chemical or organic treatment.
Sometimes a row cover might help to sort of...
Sometimes that, and of course, it's so conditional with the weather, and many people attribute wet spells to a lot of insect and disease trouble, which is true, but dry spells are equally as damaging in that regard.
Jackie emailed and wonders, how do I keep my Annabelle hydrangea from falling over? They are a good 5 years old. What kind of cage can I use?
That's a good question, because they do get top-heavy. Now, Annabelle hydrangeas, we've talked about hydrangeas recently, they'll bloom on new wood, so as well as old wood. What we do with our Annabelles each year is cut them down to about 3 inches. So we get brand-new growth up 3 to 4 feet. We get the beautiful blossoms. They still tend to flop a little bit, but in terms of a cage, you need something extremely sturdy. And something that ideally wouldn't be real conspicuous, so would support at least the half of the stems, maybe 2 foot up the side of the stems, and would support those blooms. So I can't recommend a specific type of cage, but you know, something as thin as a tomato cage wouldn't cut it. You need something a little more significant.
Actually, something, and I've never seen cages like that other than ones that people made on their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've seen people pound stakes and get some serious twine and twine them up, but you have to make it look like a little less conspicuous.
Yeah, my wife does that, and it actually works pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You can join in, too, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org with a question, or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. What are some of your favorite spots to use scented plants for accents?
Boy, that's a great question. I think my favorite spots are typically along pathways. If you have a window box or containers near any of your windows, that's a great spot to put it, out on the back deck where the fragrance is enjoyed, because the degree of fragrance is affected by things like humidity, obviously wind. And when we talk about night blooming plants, that's where you really get some nice fragrance coming into the home. Things like moonflower, night scented phlox, there's all sorts of great plants that'll do that. But again, come to the gardens and sort of test drive some of these scents and see what you like, because, again, it's sort of a subjective thing.
I kind of like the ornamental tobacco plants. Mm. Those smell wonderful, to my nose anyway.
Yeah, the Nicotiana are fragrant, although, as you said earlier, Larry, there's a lot of flowers that don't have fragrance, including some flowering tobaccos. The fragrance has been bred right out of them.
Yeah, so you have to be careful. Teresa in Green Bay, you're next. Hi, Therese.
Good morning.
Morning.
On the hydrangea topic, I have two PG hydrangea in the tree form. They're 2 years old. Last year, they both bloomed very nicely. This year, one is looking very, very good, and I can see the buds forming for the flowers. But the other one has a few yellow leaves. It didn't leaf out as well. It's just struggling, and I have no idea why they've both been treated the same way. I'm not sure what to do.
Yeah, those the PG hydrangeas are panicle-type hydrangea that that really prefer full sun. Are they both in full sun?
Yes.
Okay. Same soil, same everything.
They're about 5 feet apart.
Yeah, I wonder if there's something going on at below soil level is my only thought. Did the leaves, did they curl before they yellowed, or did they just turn yellow and start dropping?
And there's only a few that turn yellow, fortunately, but they just turn yellow.
Okay.
They didn't curl.
Yeah.
And some of them are still green, but it's just, it looks like it's, you know, May when you look at that one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just struggling. I wondered, too, I have some other perennials in that area. Would it be possible that something is crowding the root system?
Could be rocks under there or something?
No, not rocks. I mean other flowers, smaller perennials.
Well, oh, I see.
Yeah, I don't think the root competition from those would be enough to have that significant of a difference, but
okay.
It wouldn't hurt just as an experiment to do a light fertilizer and a nice soaking drench on that side that's failing, and it certainly won't hurt your perennials, but see if that perks up that hydrangea, because it's tough to diagnose what might be going on, and it sounds like it's something that needs to be addressed, obviously.
Okay, I did the fertilizer.
Oh.
I tried that first.
Oh, well, you did the right thing.
Yeah, really tough to say, to be honest. You might consider a soil sample from that side, but how old are these hydrangeas?
Just 2 years. They were put in two summers ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other thought is if they were, I'm assuming they were planted the same, but maybe on your failing hydrangea might have an issue again of establishing roots. The fact that they're only 2 years old, and you mentioned that there is some competition on that side, that might be a factor, but I would every 3 weeks do that water and fertilizer.
Okay.
For the next maybe 2 months and see if that makes any difference.
Okay.
Otherwise, you know, take some pictures and share them with some of the local nursery people in your area that would have some experience with that.
Okay, great. I'll try the every 3 week fertilizer plan first, though.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Therese. Thank you very much for calling. Sherry in Greenfield, we are on to you now. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. This is the hydrangea show, it sounds like. I have a climbing hydrangea. It's been in the spot for 3 summers, and I can't get it to bloom. It's about 4 feet wide. It's growing and tall. I'd say, looking at it right, well, it's about, I'd say, 3.5 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
It has some chlorosis, which I've tried to treat, but not all that successfully. So two questions. How do I get it to bloom? And chlorosis seems, or if that's what it's called, from my birch trees, I've heard that's what it's called when they're kind of yellowing
in certain
areas.
Sure.
What can I do to get this thing to bloom?
Okay. Well, the chlorosis and the not blooming aren't connected at this point.
Okay.
Climbing hydrangeas, I'll give you an example at Rotary Gardens. We have many, but we have this archway going into our sunken garden where we have two huge specimens. It took them 7 years to finally bloom after they were planted.
Wow.
And I've heard stories, you just have to have a little patience.
Okay.
They will bloom, but that chlorosis concerns me a little bit. And the thing with hydrangeas is they do prefer slightly acidic soil.
Mm-hmm.
So you might want to consider like a muriacid or some sort of acidified fertilizer, and that'll take care of that chlorosis. And a healthier plant over the sequence of the next couple of years, you'll probably get blooming sooner. Of course, you'll get better growth, better root establishment, and those flowers will come.
All right, so muriacid and often. I've kind of sporadically done it, and my other hydrangeas, I think I have the same issue in my yard with other hydrangeas. The soil must not be acid enough.
Right, and they only need slightly acidic soil. And the other, an organic way to approach it would be to get some shredded oak leaves or maybe peat moss or something of that nature and work it around the root system, work it around the soil. That'll certainly help. But again, a couple well-timed applications of acidified fertilizer will green them right up.
All right, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Vicki in Madison, your turn. Hold on a second here. Let me get you on. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I don't have a hydrangea question.
Okay.
And I actually live in Edgerton. I have it's probably 35 or 40 foot tall pine tree. I don't exactly know what kind it is. I've lived on this property for about 11 years. It has very good drainage. I don't know how deep the topsoil is, but it's limestone. This year it started turning brown, and in the last month almost the whole entire tree is brown. There's just a few green sprigs on the ends, and then the very top is green, but the rest of it looks dead. And I've looked in the bark, I've looked for mites, I can't find anything.
Okay. Is the tree near the road at all?
Well, it's probably about 30 feet from a frontage road. There's a hedge that runs alongside it. The hedge is not affected. I also have different types of flowering trees on both sides of the yard that are not affected. It's just a pine tree.
Yeah, I just asked simply because pines are not resilient to any sort of salt damage, and it doesn't sound like that would be a factor in this case.
Okay.
I would cut a sample of that because pines get something that naturally called a two-year needle drop. They don't keep their needles forever. They shed needles. But what you're seeing is something extremely dramatic, of course. And the fact that you just have green on the tips is a huge concern. I would look further into the branching, further in along the stems, and look at the branchlet tips and see if you also see green needles.
Okay.
Or the emergence of green needles, because it could have gone through some stress and is trying to recover that growth. And in that case, you would need lots of water and to pamper it, but that doesn't address the fact, the question of what happened to it. And that's where I think maybe a sample taken to an extension agent would help, because it sounds like it's something that it hasn't reared itself in the past or shown any evidence of this browning.
I've never seen it before. I think this tree was planted in the 60s. My biggest concern is it's on the north side of our property, and there's an open field and then a highway, and some really big winds come through there.
Mm-hmm.
I have power lines on two sides of it. My house is on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just worried if it's truly dying, if I need to have it taken down.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't worry about removal until you assess if there is going to be some regrowth. The unfortunate thing is this is the worst time of year for a tree to try to regenerate needles or leaves, so that's where additional watering and pampering would help. But if this is something that's going to happen annually, it would be obviously a concern. So tough to diagnose it, but I do wish you the best and try to get some additional help from your area.
Yeah.
So if I bring a piece down to Rotary Gardens, because I don't live that far from you, can somebody take a look at it?
Well, your best bet would actually head to the Rock County Courthouse and look up Mike Maddox, who's our Rock County Extension agent, and leave that sample for him, and he can take a gander at it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. We had a Facebook question from Gigi. Do you have tips on keeping cut flowers and roses fresher longer in vases?
Cut flowers aren't my deal, but I tell you, when we've done cut flowers, or my experience with cut flowers, we typically will cut in the morning, and we recut the stems under running water. And that's something you should do with roses as well. So running water or underwater, and that helps maintain a lot of moisture in the stem itself. I would encourage her to talk to a local florist and get some advice on that.
And Martha wondered from Edgerton wondered if or mentions that there are heavy duty tomato cages that do support hydrangeas. Works best to clip them in a vertical line from top to bottom in one place, then bend them outwards to accommodate the plant. They're inconspicuous and work well. I haven't seen those, but that's good to know.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Heavy duty tomato cages.
Mm-hmm.
Mike from Mequonago, I have a purple sand cherry, and it's covered with greenish beetles. What are they? Where do they come from, and how do you get rid of them? Japanese beetles, maybe?
tough to say if they're metallic and sort of a brownish green, and Japanese beetles will pillage anything in the plum family, including the sand cherry. Probably Japanese beetles, and we talked earlier about some different control methods, but they're extremely frustrating. If it's not a Japanese beetle, I would encourage this person to take a sample to somebody. Tough to say, and the question is, are they eating the leaves? He's observing them, but are they doing something to the plant? And my guess is probably yes.
And another way to do it would be to take a photo of a digital photo and email it to the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. A lot of people do that, and Phil Pelletieri can take a look at the bug and tell you right away what it is. So that's another way you could do it. We have Steve in Iola with a question next. Hi, Steve. Let's see. Hold on a second. Now I've got you. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I was wondering what you do for deer control for your gardens.
Great question. When I started at the gardens 13 years ago, we had very little deer damage. We're situated in a green belt. However, we've seen an increase in the deer population, so we've had horrible deer damage in the gardens, particularly in winter. We've resorted to a lot of physical barriers. We're around our arborvitae or our smaller pines or tastier plants that we know deer will target. We put up a double layer of snow fencing. So we have between 7 and 8 foot of snow fencing placed about 3 foot away from the actual edges of the plant. And that distance is perfect because the deer are wary of trying to jump in there, and we know how they can jump. And it's just high enough that they can't lean in and nibble. Is that realistic for homeowners? That's a good question, because we're putting out probably 5,000 lineal feet of this fencing just to screen our stuff. We've also used various repellents, things like liquid fence, deer away. There's many, many different types of repellents. The issue with repellents is they frequently require reapplication depending on how the season is going. So I can't really address summer damage with deer because we're not seeing it at the gardens. It's a winter thing for us. Mm-hmm. But there's lots of information online on how to deal with it. And we had some advice from the DNR. They came through and saw our extensive damage and mentioned getting dogs through the gardens. And the idea that dog urine is a deterrent. If there's any scent of a potential predator, the deer tend to stay away. However, we know when they're hungry, there's not much that'll stop them. So I've talked in circles a little bit. I know it didn't answer your question real well, but it's a frustration, and it sounds like you're experiencing it.
Yeah, they come out of the woods just to eat my trees.
Yeah, man. Wish we had more help there for you, Steve. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And a lot of listeners would love to have the perfect answer for that, for sure. Mark Dwyer, landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening to this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest Mark Dwyer of the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. Emily in Shatek up next with a question. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I would like to know your thoughts on white clover as a turf.
Okay.
Boy, I tell you, I don't have a lot of experience with using that as an alternative ground cover. I will say I'm not a huge fan of turf and all the inputs that it requires.
Yeah, right.
And, of course, I'll contradict myself, and because at Rotary Gardens we have pretty good turf, and of course, there's again, those inputs are amazing, particularly watering at this time of year. But clover is a lot tougher plant, and white clover I think would be a functional ground cover. My concern would be its reseeding, and would it get into different areas of your garden that you wouldn't want it?
I have a good-sized patch in the backyard, which is shady. I'm wondering, would it grow in the, like, where there's full sun or mostly sun?
Yeah, oh, sure. Sure, it would. And frankly, white clover used to be part of every lawn mix.
Yeah, I don't know why they got rid of it.
Well, some people didn't like the look of it. It fixes nitrogen, so it provides fertilizer as well. So that's why it was, or one of the reasons why it was always part of a lawn mix.
Well, it sounds like a very green solution if there isn't a bad effect.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's worth a try. Half my yard is, my backyard at home is clover, and I'm happy to have it.
Oh, okay. I thank you kindly.
Yep. Sure. Thanks a lot for calling. Darcy in Greendale. Hello to you.
Good morning. I had an unusual thing happen the other day. I was out in my yard. We do have a lawn, although it's new. We just had landscaping done, so they seeded the yard. And when I was walking, my feet turned orange. And I was wondering, is there a rust?
Yes.
Mold or something that's in your and it could damage my lawn.
It's a rust.
Yep, it's just a common rust, which isn't which is typical. And with a new lawn, I'm sure you're irrigating it and keeping it nice and damp to get it growing. And typically, in issues of moisture, will help encourage rust. And it's one of those things that once we get a little more of a dry spell, it really is more of a cosmetic thing. It never looks good on your shoes, but it's not something that'll perpetuate and be a problem through the rest of the season. It's more conditional with the way your environment's going right now.
Okay, and it won't affect any of my other plants?
Well, rust can affect a lot of different types of plants, and I guess I'm not the best person to talk about it in terms of control or what the potential impacts are, but again, it's an issue of typically excess watering or I shouldn't say excess watering, but a lot of moisture. So as we head into summer, you start to see less issues of rust.
Yeah. And we do have Doug Soldat will be coming on Garden Talk. Oh boy. Next week, is it? Next week he'll be on to talk about lawns. So be sure to listen in, Darcy, and phone back with your question again. But I think Mark's got it pretty well nailed. I think he's got it pretty well nailed. Joe in Wales, we're on to you now. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. Mark, I just had some grading done in my yard. Really good job grading. Trying to grow new grass. A little bit of a problem with the weather being what it is. But the grass, some of the grass is coming up, you know, regular lawn grass. But I'm also getting this bright green multi-leaf grass that's coming up as well. Can you tell me what that is, and is there a way to defeat that, or do I have to start all over again?
No, I don't think you'll need to start all over. The issue, that's probably crabgrass.
Okay.
And we're seeing it at Rotary Gardens, and it certainly is a lighter shade of kind of a dark chartreuse. It's very conspicuous amongst the rest of your grass, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. It's like this really bright, almost fluorescent green.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and crabgrass is a seasonal. It's an annual, and there is crabgrass control that you would do next spring.
Okay.
So it's going to look a little goofy through the rest of the year, and there are some chemicals that will treat crabgrass later in the season, but they tend to be a little more on the nasty side.
Okay.
I would encourage you to talk to a local garden center or someone who knows turf and look into some of those options. But again, your other control is next spring, and we do all of our crabgrass control in spring, and it's a timing issue. I can't give you an exact date because it depends on how the spring is going, but get a little advice on that, and maybe with a two-punch method, a little treatment this summer, and then hitting again in spring with a pre-emergent control to keep it from germinating, and you'll take care of it.
And I can go ahead and after several cuttings, I could still do my weed control and also just do normal fertilization to help develop the lawn?
Yes, absolutely. I wouldn't stop anything you're doing because of this infiltrator,
okay.
But do get a little more advice on how to deal with it. And going back to my start of my comments, I'm guessing it's crabgrass. Maybe take a sample and confirm that. But that's what we're seeing at the gardens as well.
Okay, great. That's a big help and makes me feel better about looking at that that weird part of the lawn.
Okay. Thanks, Joe.
Bye.
Doris in Mequon. It's your turn. Hi, Doris.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, what can I do about buckthorn? I have an acre of land. There's buckthorn on three of the perimeters, and it's 4 to 6 feet deep, and it comes back with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm. Buckthorn is so notorious throughout the Midwest and in eastern part of our country. As everyone knows, it's spread typically by birds in the berries. We've had a lot of buckthorn at the gardens, and here's how we deal with it. It's near impossible to dig out. Manual control is very difficult. We wait until October, and in your climate, wait till most of the leaves have dropped from other plants, deciduous material, and what you'll see is the buckthorn will retain green leaves almost till November. So when everything else has dropped its leaves, the buckthorn will still be green, and that's the best way to identify it. So you're heading out in mid-October, late October. We cut all of our buckthorn down to about an inch off the ground level. And these are trunks that could be a half inch, an inch, 3 inches, 4 inches in diameter. Regardless of the diameter or the size of that plant, we cut it close to the ground, and then we take concentrated Roundup. This is the full-strength concentrate. And we just put a couple brush strokes on the trunk itself. That time of year, there's a lot of movement in that woody plant down into the root system. So by doing this herbicide, selective herbicide, you're just addressing the trunk itself. We've had 90% control on our buckthorn by doing it in fall. And we've avoided having to dig them. The problem for you, you'll have perpetual seedlings from birds bringing it in from outside your property. But if you're vigilant, you can keep up with it in the fall.
Oh, boy.
There you go. And goats work pretty well, too. There are actually, I noted in Colorado, I believe, there's a family that has like 100 goats, and they actually go to areas where they have buckthorn and other types of plants, and they let the goats in.
Oh, wow.
And the goats eat them up.
Interesting.
So goats can work too, Doris. Thanks for calling. David in La Crosse, on to you. Hi, David.
Hi, Larry. And my question, I've heard before you've talked about creeping Charlie and having to tear it out and try to rip it out. And then I was having someone come by recently and say that maybe some potential to get rid of it in a more, you know, natural way without having to tear out the whole lawn. Now, my neighbor has the creeping Charlie, you know, probably about 30 feet by about 70 feet, and it's kind of making its way over in areas of my lawn. Just wondering, does this speaker have a chance to address that issue of creeping Charlie and how I might get rid of it?
It's a great question, and it's a common question because it takes up a lot of space, and it really knows no bounds once it gets established. There's been a lot of folk remedies and trying to deal with it. And I, going back to what you had heard previously, at Rotary Gardens, we actually will decimate the entire area because there's controls I've heard using borax, soap, to knock it back, and it does, but then it recolonizes. So a lot of the treatments, the folk remedies, as I say, have been very temporary, and maybe some other listeners have an idea on how to deal with it in a more organic or appropriate method. But in areas at Rotary Gardens, we've had to herbicide the entire area and skim it off and start over. And that's just the reality for us, so we know it's gone and we don't have to worry about recolonization.
Your problem is your neighbor. Unless your neighbor controls it, you're probably not going to have good success. I mean, typically it's controlled in the fall, right around the time of the first frost. There are, if you're going to use herbicides, there are herbicides applied then. And oftentimes they look healthy, but they winter kill. The plants will winter kill if you get a good winter. And then the other time is in the spring when they're flowering, and that's the other time that herbicides are effective in controlling them. If you want to use herbicides, those are really the times to do it.
Yeah, I was around this spring. I think I got a cramp in my hand.
Well, as long as your neighbor still has it, you're probably never going to be rid of it.
So, or else wait for a tough winter and then deal with it early next spring then. Hopefully it's a bad winter.
Well, the fall season is probably, the fall is one of the best times, probably the best time. If you can catch it just right after a first frost and you usually get a warm spell, that's a good time to apply an herbicide. And it'll look like nothing's happened, but oftentimes it weakens the plant enough that they winter kill.
Yeah, it's my first year having it, so hopefully it's...
It would be a good time to get after it.
Okay, thanks.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Teresa in Heartland, we are on to you now. Hi, Teresa.
Hello. I have a couple questions. First of all, I've been having bad luck with my tomatoes the last couple years. I get them where I put them in pots so that I can move them around if I have to. But they'll get where they just get the blossoms on, and then a few days later, the blossoms are all totally eaten off. the plant is actually eaten, not just the, you know, spots on the leaves like a bug or something. It's actually eaten the whole branch, the whole top of the branches of the tomatoes. I don't know. There's a lot of gophers around.
Gophers, squirrels, rabbits.
Squirrels and rabbits and everything.
They can all do that.
And something gets up in the downspouts all the time.
Yeah, it's too bad you couldn't position a camera overnight, one of the cameras that would film what's going on. But
oh, yeah.
It's tough
because
to say.
It's happened the last couple of years, maybe even three. Mm-hmm. And then last year I just brought in the plants and they started new blossoms again, but it took until November before I got blossoms again.
Oh,
and
sure.
I didn't get no tomatoes all summer.
Mm-hmm.
Chipmunks will often, Judith says.
And then I got the bug, that white bugs or something on the plants when I brought them in the house.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Chipmunks are notorious for it, so that would be my guess.
Oh, and they can climb up that high on them because I even have one up in a higher pot.
Mm. Oh, they can climb along. They can climb very high. If there's any way at all for them to climb, they will definitely climb.
Eat the whole plant?
Well, they'll usually not.
Yeah, that's a little surprising. You might want to consider get some crushed red hot peppers and sprinkle it around the base of the plant, and just that the scent of that it deters a lot of critters, a lot of rodents, and give that a whirl and see if that helps out at all.
Makes good sense. Mark Dwyer, our guest today, landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. Our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest Mark Dwyer, landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. And I'd certainly invite you to go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We've posted the website for the Rotary Gardens. Take a look at what's going on there. There's a lot going on there. Lots of beautiful things to see and smell as well. Gene and Bloomer has a question for you, Mark. So let's go to Gene. Hi, Gene.
Yeah, hi, Larry. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I got a good question for you. I got a couple kinds of morning glories here, the purple ones, and then I planted some blue ones as plants. And I have them about 6 feet tall now, and they're going close to 7 feet tall, and there isn't a blossom on the blue ones yet. And I have a question, what do they need to blossom out? The purple ones are all blossomed as they're going up, and they aren't near that tall, but the blue ones that I bought from plants are like six and a half feet tall now.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the thing with morning glories, surprisingly enough, they do the best when they're in leaner soils. And
yeah,
we've seen morning glories or even grown morning glories at the gardens in overly rich soil where there's been lots of vine growth, lots of leaf growth, but no flowers.
Okay.
So in areas where the soil's a little tougher, we tend to see better blooming or even earlier blooming. So the thought is with your blue morning glory, it still may bloom, or is it maybe in better soil than the others?
Well, I did give it Miracle-Gro. You know, all of them I give them Miracle-Gro, the purple ones too, and they've been blooming pretty good. The purple ones have been blooming, and they aren't near as leafy, but these blue ones are just leafy.
Right.
I built a cage like 6 feet tall, and they're going beyond that. If I should just water them now or what I should
do. I'd lay off the Miracle-Gro for sure.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They got a few brown leaves on the bottom. I don't know what that would mean.
I wouldn't worry about that, but as Larry's suggestion, I wouldn't fertilize any of them anymore and see how they do. I think they'll be all right.
Okay, yeah, okay, because then I kind of like to see the blossom come, and then they usually seed themselves the next spring, see, and I want it blue with the purple,
There you go. Well, good.
I got about 6 feet apart, you know, 6-8 feet apart.
Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll lay off of the fertilizer and the Miracle-Gro and just water them, I guess, and see what happens, huh?
Sounds like a plan.
Sounds good. Thanks, Gene. Thanks for calling. Sarah in Zion, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Sarah.
Well, hi. Thanks a lot. I have some desperate mulching needs for my tomatoes because I have a big garden where there's no water source. I've been driving over, like, gallons of water, and I'm really tired of it. And I've been pulling up, there's tons of weeds. It's an abandoned field, so I've just been layering, like, freshly pulled weeds. Is that a really bad thing? And then if I get a pine mulch, is that going to be okay for the tomatoes, or is the acidity wrong? Or
Well, first of all, I don't think I'd use the weeds as a mulch because, again, some of them may be going to seed. And although your intent is right, I think I would steer towards the pine needles. That would be fine. Shredded leaves are good. The issue with organic mulches is you want to make sure that they're relatively aged. And what I mean by that is if you throw, say, fresh pine needles on there or use fresh shredded bark or something that's relatively new, that may rob some of the nutrients out of the soil. It does; they do utilize nitrogen to as they degrade, so that would be a concern. And it sounds like your interest in mulch is also functional in terms of not only weed control but also maintaining moisture, and that makes total sense. Tomatoes can also be mulched with plastics and others, but it doesn't necessarily help with water retention. So I would try the pine needles if they're older, you know, if they're yellow and they've been under a tree for a while.
No, I live in an apartment, so that's why I have to go to this other place. And so I don't have, like, yard waste at my disposal. But
sure.
Like, at the Kmart near me, they've got these enormous bags of, like, some sort of forest product, pine forest mulch. And I don't know about that.
I don't know that would be bad, to be honest.
Okay.
Although, be careful. You don't want to pile the mulch too much on the side of the tomato. You want to make sure that stem is fairly clear. But surrounding that root zone, I think, would be fine for the functionality that you want.
Okay. And then if I water, do I have to see, is it okay if I dump all the water like on the inside of the mulch, or do I have to get it under the mulch somehow?
Well, ultimately it'll permeate through that mulch, and as you're finding, your tomatoes are extremely thirsty, so it's difficult to overwater a tomato, but you do need to consider that the mulch will absorb some of that. But if you water them well enough, it'll get right through that mulch, and that mulch will help retain moisture in the soil beneath.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Jim in West Allis, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Larry and Mark. I am growing pumpkins for the first time this year in my city lot, and I got lots of leaves, lots of vines and flowers, but no pumpkin. Am I a little bit early for waiting for that?
Yep, just a little early. This year at the gardens, we have a huge squash collection, which, of course, they're all in the same family. And we're just seeing the start of fruit formation. So give it a little time. The fact that you have blossoms, those will be pollinated shortly, and you'll start to see the start of fruit within the next probably 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay. Now, if I lower the amount of vines I have, does that mean I'm going to get bigger and larger pumpkins?
Yes, actually, limiting the number of flowers per plant. And, you know, the way they grow those huge pumpkins is they'll limit it to one flower on a plant. And all the energy goes into making one of those huge pumpkins. Of course, there's varieties that are prone to being large to start with. But yes, if your vines are real vigorous and you want larger fruit, remove some of the vines and or even pick some of the flowers off. They won't be pollinated. And again, energy will go into, in water resources, et cetera, will go into larger fruit on the rest of those flowers.
Great. Lots of water or just let it run by itself?
I would give lots of water.
Yeah.
You know, they're very drought-tolerant. Pumpkins will do fairly well out in a field with no irrigation. But if you can supply that watering, I would do it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot for calling. I had a Facebook question from Sandy in Eau Claire. I planted 6 rows of green beans. The rabbits have chewed them down. There are still some leaves on them. My question is, if I put some floating row covers on, will they leaf out again and get beans on them? I'd say yes.
They'll certainly leaf out again, and if you protect them from being nibbled, you may see more flowers and also bean production, but there's no doubt they'll recover vegetatively, but the question is, how many more beans will they form? Tough to say.
Her second question has to do with golden honey locust. We trim it back a lot each fall. For the past 10 years we've been doing it. It comes back with a lot of vigor. 1 year it had thorns on it. After that, it's never had thorns since.
Mm. Well, thorns on a honey locust are a juvenile condition, and younger honey locusts, you sometimes will see thorns. Some of that severe pruning may have just triggered some sort of response. I guess I'm not the best person to ask on that. That sounds interesting, but I imagine it was the pruning that instigated that.
Jerry in Milwaukee wonders, you spoke about yellowing leaves versus curling leaves. What's the difference? I have both, Gary says.
Sure. Well, I asked that question regarding the hydrangea because I was wondering, did the leaves were they yellow? Were they solid leaves? They hadn't curled in terms of any sort of drought or fungal issue. Were they just turning yellow, which might indicate some sort of root condition? The curling might be indicative of something else. And if you have curling yellow leaves, that could be a whole range of things. So basically, my verbal question was simply to clarify mm-hmm. what was happening with the leaf. Was it also curling, or was it just turning yellow and maybe falling off? And then again, that dictates or leads to certain, those symptoms might be indicative of something specific.
Mm-hmm. And Terry in Hobart uses table pepper or ground hot peppers to deter deer. Seems to work for him. So that's good to know. Mm-hmm. And John lives next to undeveloped Milwaukee County land, which has in recent years had a heavy growth of garlic mustard along the wood edge. This year, there's very little of it. I wonder if it's experiencing a cycle which will result in less dominant place in our flora in the future.
I've not heard of anything, any secular nature with garlic mustard, because it's unbelievably invasive, as most people know. And I would be concerned that he observed that space and make sure there's, you know, as a biennial, there still may be baby plants out there that'll be the bloomers next year. The best way to deal with garlic mustard, whether it's manual or herbicide removal, is in very early spring before almost everything else leaves out. And for us, that's late March, early April. It's nice and green then, and we can target it and take care of it.
And a Facebook question from Danielle. I have a question about my red maple tree. Last year, the bark split and wrapped it, but this year it's leafed out, but a few of the main branches seem dead. Should I trim them off, and will it survive? The tree is about 14 inches in diameter and 40 feet tall.
Well, it sounds like a good tree. I think if it's confirmed deadwood, if those branches are dead, and get in there and scratch them a little bit, see if there's any green underneath those stems, that warrants removal for sure. And I would encourage him to have an arborist take a look at it, because it sounds like he obviously wants to save the tree.
Yeah.
And by thinning it out and taking care of that issue, and maples are pretty tough. I think it may come through that.
Laura in Jackson, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I planted about 100 lilies for my daughter's wedding. I planted half of them last fall and half of them in spring. Unfortunately, the variety that I picked that I planted in fall doesn't seem to be quite catching up to their bloom time and ready for the wedding tomorrow, but I do have the other 50 of the Oriental Stargazers, the white, and then the classic Stargazer lilies,
mm-hmm.
and they look like they're ready to pop. Do you have any suggestions for me of how I can make them, force them to bloom by tomorrow?
Boy.
No.
someone had told me, a florist had told me, I could cut them and put them in very warm water and put them in the sun, and then run my finger up the buds, try to kind of break them, force them to open.
Hmm.
But I don't know. Do you have any suggestions? It's a desperate mother of the bride.
Oh.
I know. I can hear it in your voice. I apologize. I don't have a recommendation. And I understand that concept of cutting them. But the issue with that, and many plants can be forced very quickly into bloom by cutting them and doing that. But will that happen before tomorrow? I don't know.
And then I'm just going to have to give it a try.
Yeah, maybe call a florist, maybe. They might have an idea.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. Right. I enjoy your show, and you have a nice weekend.
Yeah, you will. I hope you have a great weekend, too, Laura.
Thank you.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, boy. Mom and daughter may have, well, no, they won't have words. She's doing her best. She's trying mm-hmm. her hardest, and if she cuts those flowers and they open, everything will be fine. Tina in Oshkosh, your turn now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a young rhododendron. It'll be 3 years old in the fall, and I'm having some landscaping done. I had it taken out. It wasn't really thriving, and I don't remember under what conditions I planted it in the first place. I probably didn't get the soil prepared correctly or whatever. But it's time for me to replant it now, and I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions as to what I should use to do it the right way this time.
Sure. Well, rhododendrons love acid soil universally. So this is your opportunity to, with the second go-around here, is to make sure your planting site is heavily amended with organic material. I mentioned earlier peat moss is a good soil acidifier. You need really well-drained soil is vital for rhododendrons. And not knowing your soil, I'm not sure what you would contend with if you were to just say put it in the ground today.
Yeah.
But lots, again, of organic matter. We like peat moss. We've also incorporated in our soil, which hasn't our soil has a very neutral pH. We've incorporated mulched pine needles.
Okay.
And we've also had to resort to using slow-release sulfur as a soil additive just to bring the pH down where our rhododendrons are doing halfway decent.
Okay.
It's, yeah.
Can I get that? I guess I've not seen that, the pine, what did you say, the mulchy pine. Can I get that at the local hardware store or garden center?
I would ask around. Tough to say in your area. In our area, we can find it. But if you go to a garden center and ask for, I would mention your exact question for us and mention that to them, and I think you'll get some sound advice on how to deal with it.
Okay. And shade, and does it like a lot of water? I guess I assumed it would.
Well, is this an evergreen rhododendron or an azalea that loses its leaves? Do the leaves stay green over winter?
Yes.
Okay.
For the most part.
Well, you know, it's actually a myth that rhododendrons prefer shade. They actually can tolerate a lot of sun. They need some sort of sunlight.
Okay.
And I've seen some of the best rhododendrons in Janesville are in full blazing sun. They just have really good soil and plenty of water. And you hit the nail on the head. They do need lots of water to keep those leaves going.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And Lynn in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I have two questions that are unrelated. One is I have some strawberries in a pot on my deck that are doing very nicely, but I'd like to get them into the ground for winter. And the only place I have is near an asparagus bed, and I'm wondering if it would bother the asparagus to plant them nearby.
No.
I've not heard any issues with that combination. I think that would be fine.
Okay. And the other is I've never heard anybody here speak about Kushaw squash. And we planted it. I grew up with Kushaw. It's apparently a white pumpkin, and it's delicious in pies. And I've planted it this year, and it is doing beyond thriving.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And I just wanted to know if you're familiar with this squash and what you think about it.
I am familiar with it. I think it's wonderful. And I don't know if you heard earlier, but I mentioned at Rotary Gardens we have a huge squash collection this year, including summer squash and winter squash, and a lot of heirlooms and a lot of the real fancy varieties. I think most people, when they go to the grocery store, they see, you know, yellow crookneck and pumpkins and a lot of the very common butternut, etc. But the Kushaw is an awesome squash, and ours are doing very well also, and we hope people will come see them and see the merit of them.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Scott in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi, guys.
What's on your mind?
I've got some beautiful cucumber plants. And then not too far from them, I've got a volunteer melon. And I was told that I don't want that melon growing close to my cucumbers with the fear of perhaps some crossing to make some strange hybrids. Is that true?
Boy, that's a great question. I'm not sure about that. I guess what would be the danger in keeping the melon? Do you save your seeds every year?
No, I don't. But it's come up where I have traditionally grown melon.
Okay. Yeah, I don't.
And I was told that I might get some strange fruit from both plants.
Hmm. I'm at a loss, to be honest.
Do they cross? Is the question? Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't think they cross, but
tough to say. Or maybe it would be a neat experiment if the hybrid fruit was interesting, but a melon cucumber cross. I've never heard of that.
I haven't either.
Okay.
I would get a second opinion on that beyond talking with us, of course. But tough to say.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, you could call your local extension office, your county extension office, and there'll be a master gardener there or the horticulturist who might have an opinion on it. I don't think it's an issue, but I'm not the expert for sure. Caller Lynn from Hubertus said that well water's high copper content can cause the orange color in a lawn too, and I guess that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And Darwin in Delafield has potted jasmine plants that he loves for their scent. They're starting to send up vining tendrils. Is that usual? And should he be providing some support for them to climb on?
Yes, that is normal, and I would provide the support. The jasmines will go berserk very shortly here.
Caller would like to know if you can grow cherry trees from cherry pits. If not, can you use them for mulch?
Boy, good question. I've not grown cherries from the pits. That is the seed of the plant, although many of the cherries are propagated vegetatively to maintain variety integrity. In terms of a mulch, I'm not sure. I don't know how long it would take to break down. I'd be concerned about if those pits are viable and will germinate. If you use them as a mulch, you may have an issue of a lot of seedlings.
Yeah.
Again, a second opinion on that, I think, would be in order.
And Lenny in Green Bay has a comment on those crossing seeds. Lenny, hi.
Hi. Yes, you don't have to worry about anything crossing this year. If you're saving seed, the crossed plants would be the product of the seeds that you're saving from this year and planting for next year.
Ah, there you go.
Good point. Thank you.
Thank you so much for straightening us out on that. Well, we were right. we were right. It's good to have somebody confirm that. A caller in Webster, Wisconsin, has used motion-activated sprinklers to keep deer away overnight, and it seems to work like a charm.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard that before, and I've heard that it works. And from Dave in Wausau, do knockout roses need to be fertilized during the summer? If so, what fertilizer should be used and how often?
Well, a good question. You know, knockout roses and many of these tough shrub roses have been promoted as no care.
Yeah.
And they'll do very well in a wide range of soils. We have a lot of knockout roses in our collection. We fertilize our shrub roses every 3 weeks, and we use a balanced fertilizer, something that provides, say, a 10-10-10 or a 12-12-12. Mm-hmm. No reason to go heavy on the phosphorus, and phosphates are a huge problem in our environment. But again, a balanced fertilizer every 3 weeks. We do it from June all the way through early September, and that seems to help out. And a knockout is a darn tough rose, but a little extra fertilizer certainly won't hurt.
Roxanne and Frederick, your turn now. Hi, Roxanne.
Larry. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
I actually had two, but she said I had to prioritize. My first question is about mock orange. And I have two that I think came as volunteers from the mother plant who has since kind of passed away. A couple of years ago, my neighbor set a little fire and it got into my backyard and kind of singed them. And I've noticed that the main branches, the main stalk of it is kind of dormant, but it's putting out new little shoots. I've needed to move them. Can I do it? Have they been traumatized too much? Should I wait till they get reestablished?
Right. I don't think I'd encourage a move at this point. See how it does through the summer. If it's looking pretty good by September, I would say go for it. Move it in mid-September. If it still looks like it's struggling, I would wait until mid-April next year.
Okay.
The issue with moving it next spring is that you may cause some stress that would affect the spring blooms, but the best times to move a mock orange would be this fall. The other thought is wait till it's done blooming, if it blooms next spring.
Mm-hmm.
Just see how it recovers, but it's too early to do it now.
Okay, so if these two are, in fact, suckers off the mother plant, should I do the spade thing in between to make sure there are no roots that are joining them?
That would be effective. What is your concern with doing the separation?
Just that they're fairly good sized.
Okay. Sure. Yes, I would do that.
Okay. And they're in a shady area, so that's why I need to move them.
Mm, yep. Get them in the sun.
Okay. Do you have time for my snowball question?
Quick one.
Okay. I have a really old heirloom snowball, which I think is part of the hydrangea family. And, I'm wondering when is the best time to move that. And
Okay.
It is also in the shade.
I've heard snowball refer to viburnums as well. Are you sure it's a hydrangea?
No, it just looks like it because it's got that snowball.
Okay. Yeah, it still might be a viburnum, but your best time to move those would be late summer or early fall. I would also do that when they're entirely done blooming and soil temperatures are still warm in September. Move them and just keep them watered until the ground freezes.
And there you go. Thank you very much for calling in. Mark, thank you so much for being with us today. It was great fun. I hope you'll come back.
I will.
Mark Dwyer is landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. Visit the gardens. You'll see some wonderful things there. Go to our website at the Larry Mueller Show, and you'll get a preview of what things look like at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. We've got a post there to their webpage. Monday, we'll talk with the author of Sheepish, Two Women, 50 Sheep, and Enough Wool to Save the Planet. Our weather guys join us as well. Stay with us.